Welcome to Willoughby Hills. I'm Heath Rosella. I am your host. Welcome to my podcast. Welcome to another episode. Thank you for joining me. Sarah Mock is my guest today. Sarah's an agriculture reporter. She's an author. She's a podcast producer, podcast host. She's got a great new podcast from Ambrook Research called The Only Thing That Lasts, looking at land issues and farmland and all sorts of interesting stuff there. We're going to dive into the new podcast today. She's also the author of two books, Farm and Other F-Words, and Big Team Farms. So we are going to be talking about farming today. Before we get to Sarah's interview, I just wanted to share I am fresh off of a week in Hawaii, and I am feeling really, really good. I got connected to an organic grower out there many years ago when I was working at Ask This Old House. We shot an episode in Hawaii, and one of our goals was to not just tell kind of the colonized version of the Hawaiian story and, you know, Elvis Presley and Waikiki Beach, but to try to tell a more authentic story. And we worked with PBS Hawaii, who hooked us up with an amazing organic farm there called Ma'o Organic Farms. They hooked us up with a really cool Native Hawaiian family, and Ma'o worked with us to install an organic garden at this woman's house. And we talked all about just the importance of food in the Hawaiian diet and what's native to the islands, what is the indigenous diet, all that kind of stuff. So flash forward to this trip, my wife and I are going into it and saying, you know what, we don't want to just go to the grocery stores. We don't want to just go to the restaurants and, you know, sort of not know where the food is coming from or what it's going to be. We want to have a better sense of place as we're eating this food. So I reached out to Ma'o Organic Farms and just said, hey, I'm going to be around. Can I get some produce from you? What's sort of your produce schedule? Or, you know, do you have a farm store? That sort of thing. They did not, but they recommended something even better to me. It's this service called FarmLink Hawaii, and they deliver food all over the island of Oahu that they have sourced from local farmers all across the island chain. So everything from grass-fed beef to locally raised shrimp, to coffee, honey, and of course, fruits and vegetables. We had the most amazing time just getting this fresh food, eating this fresh food, and exploring the Hawaiian culture through some food. We had poi, we had ulu, which is a breadfruit, we had pineapple, avocado fresh from Hawaii. It was some of the best eating that I've done in a long time. So I am thinking about farms a lot. I am thinking about local farms, and I'm thinking about how do we eat locally wherever we are. That's sort of where my head is right now. I wrote about this in the newsletter this week. If you're not already on the newsletter list, please go to heathrosella.com/newsletter, enter your email there and get signed up. You will not only receive every issue of the newsletter, you will also receive every podcast episode when it comes out. And if you want to be a paying member, you will help support this newsletter and podcast, and you'll get early access to the podcast. So lots of options. You can have a free subscription, you can have a paid subscription, but I hope you will check that out. Check out what I'm writing over in the newsletter talking about Hawaiian farming, because it was just the best experience and I feel so healthy coming back from that trip. It was a great time. I'm happy to be back, and I'm happy to have Sarah on the show today. So Sarah, she's a white woman from Wyoming, grew up on a farm out there. And when I say a white woman from Wyoming, that's probably not the first person that you think of who's going to be talking about racial and social justice issues around farming. But that is a big part of our conversation today. Sarah's work has been looking for a long time at the history of land ownership in this country, the history of labor, where those pieces intersect. Obviously, a lot of that, you know, land ownership comes down to indigenous rights issues and what happened when American, you know, settlers came here and colonized, took land from the indigenous people. But you can't look at those early farms without also looking at forced labor and, you know, bringing in enslaved people from Africa to work this land. So Sarah's point of view on farming is kind of right where I am these days in terms of talking about social and environmental justice issues. I was so excited to talk to her about that. So we talk a lot about issues around land, who owns it, what it means, things like that today. We're going to talk about her new podcast for Ambrook Research, The Only Thing That Lasts. I've done some writing for Ambrook. I love their platform. I love working with them. Jesse Hirsch is their editor over there. He's been a big supporter of this podcast and the newsletter, and he's the one who introduced me to Sarah. So that was awesome. And I got to say, after I got off the phone with Sarah, I helped connect her to some other people that have been on this podcast. And so it was kind of a fun networking experience all around, people that I think could help her tell some stories that she's looking to tell for this new podcast, The Only Thing That Lasts. So check that out on your favorite podcast player, The Only Thing That Lasts from Ambrook Research. Check out Sarah's books, Farm and Other F-Words, Big Team Farms, and enjoy this conversation. I learned a ton. I hope you will too. And I hope you get as much out of it as I did. So here it is, my conversation with Sarah Mock. So I want to start with just kind of understanding your background. You come from a farming family and then have been working as a farm journalist for a long time. So like, help me, I guess, connect those dots and sort of the way that you grew up and how that turned into your career.
Yeah, totally. So I grew up on a farm in Wyoming, just a little hobby farm where we raised some livestock. We grew like a market garden. I did 4-H and FFA and had a pretty... Despite the fact that my parents essentially live in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is the biggest city in Wyoming, turns out the biggest city in Wyoming's not all that big.
It's got a downtown, though. I've been to Cheyenne. I like it out there.
Yeah, it's cute and nice. And yeah, I don't know. It's all right. I get back there from time to time. But yeah, I basically like the shortest possible version is I went off to college thinking like, you know, growing up in an agricultural community, in an agriculture, I guess you could say, was interesting, but I was ready to like do something bigger and more important. I wasn't exactly sure what that was, but I was intrigued by international travel and like the State Department. And my parents were both in the military, so I was intrigued by like security stuff.
Yeah.
And while I was at school, I basically realized how truly rare it is to come from an agricultural background.
Interesting. Where'd you go for school?
I went to Georgetown.
Okay.
In DC. So that was a big switch, a little bit of a culture shock. But yeah, so I started, I was learning about international development. I was interested in kind of tying agriculture into international development. Actually got a great opportunity to spend a year abroad doing work and studying in three different countries. And my big takeaway was people in the world know how to farm and they don't really need white ladies from America to tell them how to do it. People need is basically... almost universally true that what people need is for America to stop exporting its agricultural problems elsewhere. Mm. So I came back. I was interested in how I could do that. It was 2015. So I was like, you know who has all the answers? It's Silicon Valley, because we had hope for tech back then. So I went and I worked a couple of tech jobs. I was kind of blogging on the side, just nerdy and passionate about ag issues and topics and writing whenever I could. And that somehow led into a job for RFD TV, which is a national rural TV network. Was there for 3 years, covered the Trump administration, Sonny Perdue's USDA, the signing of the 2018 Farm Bill. And then at the end of my time there, I was interested in telling kind of bigger, more investigative stories about agriculture. And basically, like, to their credit, the network was like, that's just not what we do here. Like, we do a daily news show and there's not really time for that. So I decided to take the leap, do the freelance thing, and have been doing that ever since. And I do a mix of kind of agriculture, rural issues, food journalism, but also just all kinds of other things, because I don't know if you know, but journalism's like a pretty bad way to pay bills these days.
And getting worse, like all the time.
All the time, especially for a very niche topic like agriculture.
Yeah. I want to ask, there's something that you said in there that I'm curious to dive into a little more, and that's this idea of America kind of exporting our way of agriculture. Can you expand on that a little bit? Is that just extractive and chemical fertilizers and that kind of stuff, or what does that actually look like?
Yeah, it looks a lot of different ways, actually, and it is, I would say primarily it's just a capitalistic cash crop mindset. Mm. I mean, like, the vast majority of the world still is fed by kind of smallholder, small-scale agriculture. And yet, when Americans talk about agricultural development, especially agricultural development in the kind of global South, we are always talking about how are we going to get them to use John Deere tractors to plant thousands of acres of commodity corn and soybeans and cotton.
Right.
So yeah, it's a lot of, you know, if you're not doing resource-intensive, water-intensive, chemical-intensive, equipment-intensive agriculture, that is going to drive your national GDP, then you're not doing it right. that is like the Western perspective on agriculture in the developing world. So
interesting.
Yeah, I think it's there's maybe starting to be some shifts there. People are starting to think a little bit more about like, what do property rights mean? And what role does indigenous agriculture and smallholders and kind of the global peasant movement have to offer in this wider conversation? But I mean, as long as like GDP is upheld as the way to measure whether people are doing well,
right?
I think we're still going to see a lot of intense focus on the most capitalistic types of agriculture.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting tension that you touch on in a lot of your work, that at its core, agriculture is about feeding ourselves, right? It's about nourishment. It's about feeling healthy. But it is also a business. And like, it depends on how you approach farming and agriculture informs how you do things, and that they aren't necessarily as binary as that, I guess, either, right?
Yeah. Agriculture in its most broadest description is just kind of harvesting useful things from the landscape.
Yeah.
So we harvest calories. That's maybe the most important thing, but we also harvest fuel and fiber, artisanal supplies, medicine. All of those things fall into agriculture. You know, forestry is agriculture, fuel and fiber production is agriculture. But I don't know, since at least like the dawn of colonialism or Western colonialism as we know it, agriculture has needed to have a very particular role as a driver of income, as a maker of money, not as like a subsistence activity, but as a job, essentially. No matter how good a farmer I am, I can't grow like a Verizon plan or a utility company. Yeah. Like more and more over the last 400 years, we've become more and more enmeshed in systems that defy self-sufficiency. And so at the end of the day, like you can't, if agriculture is going to be your job, that's great, but it has to create money that you can use in like a cash economy to buy these other things that you need. And I think that is not always obvious to people. I think there's still an idea that self-sufficient, I mean, go on TikTok for 15 minutes and Google homesteading or farming,
right,
and you'll get the impression that self-sufficiency is really possible and that like you can just like have a farm and live off the grid and that is your whole life. But I mean, I guess everyone you know is within walking distance of you then, because you can't be self-sufficient. You're not making your own cars.
Right.
You're not calling people. Yeah. So I don't know. The complexity that we have added to agriculture is also just the complexity we've added to like our whole society and culture.
Yeah. I mean, there's an interesting piece in your first book, The Introduction, and it kind of sets up the entire piece. But I want to read this passage because it was just so powerful when I read it. And I've gone back to this idea in my head a number of times now. So quoting here, "The tougher pill to swallow is that our amber waves of grain love affair with these farms is rooted in hundreds of years of white settler culture. It may seem benign, but the warm, fuzzy feelings we get when we shop at the farmer's market or think of old McDonald on his farm are irrevocably tied to a version of the American dream that encouraged white immigrants to take indigenous land, enslave people to work it, and transform it into cash by whatever means necessary. These are the two faces of America's agrarian dream, and they cannot be separated." Like that, wow, first of all, that's just, it sums it all up right there. And as I say, you go on for another, 200 pages or so to really kind of break that down and make it digestible and understandable. But as you talk about in that book, that was a process for you to get to that place too, and to really understand not only was this kind of the root of American agriculture, but in some ways, it's still the present in terms of just how land is valued, how labor is valued, all of that. Like, help break all of that down for me. It's a really complex question. But like, yeah, that passage was just so succinct, I guess. And it hits at all these other issues.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess I will start where your question kind of got to, which is about the land and labor dichotomy in North America, especially, when Europeans arrived in North America, especially on the East Coast, basically they were overwhelmed by the amount of this resource that was completely basically gone from the Europe they knew, which is land.
Yeah.
There is no open land that is unclaimed in essentially any part of Europe.
Yeah.
So the idea that they stumbled across this whole continent that was like in their mind up for grabs, it was claimed by their kings and therefore like the king could give it to whoever they want. That was a really like fundamentally unlocked. It happened at this very interesting historical moment where European philosophers were starting to think about like, what is property and how do we get it? And how do we, how can we justify how property is like taken out of, John Locke's, out of the state of nature? And it's very much just a big conclusion of the era was just like, when you exert your labor on something, you are claiming it for yourself. It is now your property by virtue of like God and the Bible, essentially. So there was suddenly this thing that had there never had really meaningfully been before, or hadn't been for thousands of years, which is all this free land that people could just, if you would just go and work it, you could have it. It was yours, which really overturned the way that people thought about their prospects in the world, especially for Europeans. But the problem was they came to the east coast of North America, got off the boats, and basically it was like, oh no, there's too much land. I don't have enough labor to claim all that I want. There's just not enough people. Europe is so overcrowded in this moment that like there's a whole population, like a whole sect of society that is the servant class.
Yeah.
And in America, there's none. There's none at all. And that, I, you know, is one of the biggest motivations for slavery in the New World is, or in North America, I should say, is just the desire to, you know, we need more labor. We, because if we can't hold this land with laborers, then we can't keep it.
Yeah.
So as we bring slaves here, as we enslave indigenous populations, which was also very common, you know, as long as you could say that you owned the people, then you owned their labor as well. And that was a way to claim more land. Obviously, a big part of this is just that, you know, for better or worse, there was a lot of land speculation. The earliest American colonies were business ventures. They were the Massachusetts Bay Company and the like. I mean, I think we like to talk about how America was about like religious liberty. I think there was probably some of that for sure. But European colonies in America wouldn't have existed if it didn't seem like there was money to be made here.
Sure. I mean, that was it was tobacco plantations and sugar plantations, like importing this stuff back to Europe primarily, right? At least at first.
Totally. And if you even look at like, you know, this story, America loves the story of the first Thanksgiving, which is, you know, I think the Wampanoag people would be the first to tell you is not real or true in any way.
Yeah.
But, you know, people look back at the colonial era and wonder, or the pre-colonial era, and wonder why people starved so much in North America. And I think there's a lot of just kind of like hand waving about like, they weren't that good at agriculture. They hadn't figured it out yet. These were professional farmers from Europe.
Yeah.
They were plenty good at agriculture. The problem was they were only growing cotton and tobacco. It was a cash crop. They were trying to get rich quick in America and go back to Europe. That was the plan. Like there was a little bit of subsistence, but it generally was not the focus. Which I think is, you know, when you talk about the roots of American agriculture, right? It's always been about like making money. It's never been about, you know, we are people of this land and we need to feed each other in our communities. It has always been about how can I make the most money? And, you know, I think to kind of put a bow on the labor question, you know, we had slavery. Then we even after slavery, we then went into sharecropping. We then went into the Bracero program. We went into, you know, the modern H-2A program. We've never, to this day, do not pay what agricultural labor is worth. We can't. It is like it defies the logic of agricultural economics. The trade-off of America has always been a country with a lot of agricultural land and not enough people. To like overcome that situation, you have to find some way to get labor for free or way less than it's worth. And that is what we've been doing for the last 400 years.
Yeah. I mean, right up until the present, you write about visiting a farm in upstate New York where the farmer was very open with you about his labor practices and basically paying, you know, a couple thousand dollars to these coyotes that are bringing people across the border. And, you know, there's pieces for ranch owners where people are cutting across their lands and different transport companies. And, you know, ultimately, he's kind of in this position as the farmer saying, well, I can't afford to do anything else. Like, that whole interaction was surprising to me. And I mean, I think there was like a 14-year-old girl involved as part of it too, is one of the people that he brought across. Like, it's very much human trafficking. It has very similar roots to slavery in my mind, hearing about this. I mean, they're getting paid something, but it's not even minimum wage often. Like, going and experiencing that. And I guess I'm curious, in that specific case of just talking to this farmer who was so open with you about the practices that he was doing, but kind of more generally, what surprises you about farm labor as you've been researching these topics for, you know, your career?
I'm a little jaded, so I have to say I'm not sure a ton surprises me anymore. But
okay,
yes, I think that farmer would say himself that he is involved in human trafficking. Yeah. And I think it's easy for us to kind of dismiss as like human trafficking always bad, evil people do it. And like evil people with bad intentions do it. And I think it was a valuable situation for me because I think that farmer has thought a lot about like what is good for these people. Like these people want to come here. They desperately need to have these kind of jobs. Like it's way better than they can make in Mexico. And like in a lot of ways, I think he kind of sees it as like a kind of charity to pay for this border crossing. But like a charity that certainly like benefits him still. And I think he has a similarly complicated, I think one of the reasons he was so open to talking with me about it is because he doesn't want it to be that way.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't want to have to traffic people to find workers, but if not this, then what?
Because what is the alternative? That it's expensive visa applications? Like, is there a legal route that could have been viable for him?
I think the legal route for dairy, so because dairy does not qualify for H-2A, H-2A is exclusively for seasonal employment. Dairy is year-round, right. Yep. So they don't qualify. So the alternative is essentially you just would have to pay enough to like get Americans to be interested. And right, like these jobs are like $20, $25 an hour often, but they're in rural areas. They're really demanding, 12-hour shifts usually, often like 60-hour weeks. Part of the compensation is living on the farm. They're like not super desirable jobs, frankly. It's tough. It's dirty. It's smelly. It's working with cattle. It's can be dangerous. The dairy sector has like the highest number of deaths, or one of the highest number of deaths of all agricultural sectors. And that's the thing. Maybe a decade ago, Stephen Colbert took an agricultural job. I think he was picking tomatoes in California, but
yeah.
I don't think he lasted a day. Like, it's so hard. This work is so hard, and people don't want to do it. But the real only alternative in the dairy sector is you have to find a way to make Americans want the job. And dairy farm owners don't feel like that is possible to afford. Would they have to pay $50 an hour?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, too. Just a lot of these rural communities have seen huge population declines, too. I wrote a piece maybe a year or so ago. I'd seen a little thing online of just a post office in a small town in Iowa that was like crumbling away. And I was like, what's the story there? It looks like it was part of a block. It did this whole deep dive into it, ended up calling the mayor of this small town and just said, like, what's the deal? Like, tell me the story of your play. Like, how do you get from what looks like a viable town once to, you know, a crumbling post office, and that's it? And I had done some Google Street viewing and stuff before I talked to him and could see there wasn't much left in this town. He said, look, when I was growing up here, I think in the 50s, there were 1,000 people in this town, and now there's 400, which even those numbers are like tiny. But he said there was a bank, and there was a grocery store, and there was this and that. And now I have to drive, you know, 20 miles to Walmart, and that's the only store nearby. Like, there has been kind of a hollowing out too of rural America, which has taken a lot of that labor pool. Do you think any of those conditions of kind of why people don't stay in these rural communities, or that there hasn't been vitality in these places, is any of that tied to our modern agriculture system, or is it a bigger thing? Is it a change in retail, or, you know, other ways that we do business?
Yeah, I think it's a confluence of a number of things, but I do think agriculture, especially agricultural land ownership, has a huge role to play.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the biggest things that would have been true 50 years ago in a small town in Iowa is there would have been dozens of farmers in the county, if not hundreds of farmers in the county. Many people with relatively small acreages growing a much greater diversity of things. Now Iowa's like, you know, some ridiculous percent. I mean, it's almost exclusively corn and soybeans in terms of crops. And then the density of hog production is wild.
Yeah.
Again, this is not necessarily like a indictment of farmers in particular, but it's just a fact of capitalism that, especially after the 1933 Farm Bill and the way that we prioritized technological advancement in agriculture, advancements in like kind of major infrastructure, we've decided on a policy level that big farms are best and that farms should get bigger. What that means is that, like, your neighbor who used to be, you know, the fabric of your rural community along with you, that, you know, you maintained the bank and you shopped at all the businesses and you had this great community, are now your competitors. Mm. They're owning their own farms is standing in the way of you of your survival.
Yeah.
You need to buy their land so that you can get bigger, so that you can afford the latest equipment and grow the most crops and kind of maximize your economies of scale. That's how counties in Iowa that used to have hundreds of farmers now have, you know, 20.
Yeah.
And those 20 are salivating at the bit to get each other off the land and to kind of be the last person standing. And there's like a fun, interesting kind of fact of real estate in there that's affecting it too, right? Which is that, one, farmland on average only comes up for sale once every 3 generations.
Wow.
So it's very hard to acquire farmland. And when it's up for sale, it's like the mega high priority to buy it.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there's the fact that we value real estate in this country primarily through comparison to other real estate.
Sure. Yeah.
So like the, a further emphasis to, or a further incentive not to sell farmland is because unless you ensure that it sells for more money, selling something cheap could negatively impact all the property you own nearby.
Right.
So there's fascinating kind of like weird interplays. There's also huge tax implications for how you buy and sell farmland, how much you own. Yeah, it's a very complicated story, but you know, farmland tax breaks are a big reason why schools in rural areas can't survive. Because when your whole county is mostly farmland and you know you're cutting people's taxes down to 10% of what they might otherwise be, you're making sure that all your public schools don't have any money to operate on. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a complex, everything's intertwined, but agriculture should take some responsibility for its role in the decline of rural America.
Yeah. I mean, there's an interesting piece when you talk about land consolidation too, that you talked about, and that's this idea of being land rich and cash poor, that for a lot of farmers, like an outsider like myself would look at it and say, wow, they're operating on these razor thin margins. And, you know, if they have a bad year, if there's a drought or, you know, pests come through or whatever, they might lose everything, but that they're also sitting on this very valuable land. And the way you said it, I think, was something like you wouldn't loan somebody money if they had a stash of gold, you know, like if they had just a vault of gold sitting there, you'd be like, well, sell some gold and get some cash for that. You know, like there's a barrier to entry to farm at all because of the cost of the land. But then once you get into it, it's actually not that income generating. Like the land itself is the bigger asset more than the business.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I had a source for the book that I think put it really well, which is basically that a farm is two separate businesses. A real estate business that generates income through the appreciation of property, and then a production business that generates income through the annual, you know, sale of commodities. And I will say this conversation is pretty limited to commodities because I think outside of the commodity picture, things can look really different.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the reality is most farmland in America is owned outright. Most of it's not mortgaged.
Yeah.
So most farmers are sitting on pretty significant land assets. I think one of the other complications in this conversation is that if someone owned a factory and fell on hard times, maybe people would be more open to saying like, well, maybe you should sell the factory if you need to make some money. But the idea of people selling their farmland has a very different emotional resonance than, you know, selling some other business asset, even though essentially, according to the government, according to the average ag business, like that's what farmland is. It's a production asset. It's a thing that you use to make a thing that you sell.
Yeah.
So I think there is kind of like an emotional part of that whole conversation too, but just the reality of being land rich, cash poor, which I think a lot of farmers really, really feel, is the same way that a homeowner feels when they have a mortgage.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, my mortgage essentially is a savings account.
Yeah.
It's my money I'm putting, it's not rent, which I think some farmers conflate. Certainly some farmers rent their ground and that is meaningfully different. But I think some people say, you know, I don't own my land. I have a big mortgage and I don't have any money. And so that makes me poor. But it's like, no, if you have 50% paid off on a mortgage on $10 million worth of land, you have $5 million, which is a lot of money. Yeah. Which like lots of people have things that aren't liquid, right? Like CEOs of Fortune 500 companies get paid in stock and get paid like a $1 paycheck every year. That's not very liquid either, but we don't call Jeff Bezos poor.
Yeah.
Amazon stock rich, cash poor. Like he's just rich.
Yeah.
Which I think is a challenging part of this whole thing, right? Is that agriculture can be a very low income activity. It is almost exclusively a high wealth activity.
Yeah.
You can't really do it if you're poor.
Right. You compare it to a luxury like owning a private jet or a yacht or something. Like it can be a rich person's plaything more than, you know, if somebody said, you know what, I want to start a business. I'm going to open a plumbing company or, you know, a clothing boutique or a coffee shop. Like opening a farm is a very different prospect. And it's something that often very wealthy people do as an investment or as a hobby or as both.
Totally. And I think more and more all the time, and I would guess that people in the agricultural community would be the first people to say that this is happening, especially, you know, in the West, being from Wyoming, every other ranch you hear about is being bought by some billionaire who just wants to use it as some combination of tax break and vacation home.
Yeah.
But I think that's, I mean, Bill Gates is the largest owner of cropland in the United States. The farmland picture has become increasingly complicated by outside investors coming into the space, though I will also say that 90% of U.S. farmland is still owned by individual family owners. So despite the like fear of outside investors and foreign land buyers in particular, really most farmland is still owned by farmers and the descendants of farmers.
I mean, this gets to the podcast nicely. You know, this new show, The Only Thing That Lasts, the first episode explicitly tries to answer the question of, are we running out of farmland, and touches on this Bill Gates issue. And I mean, even for me, like, you know, down the street from me when I moved to this house 15 years ago, there was a big Christmas tree farm that, I don't know, 20, 30 acres, and you could go and cut your own. They sold that off maybe 10 years ago, and it's now housing development, and it's, you know, McMansions just all built on big lots on what I remember walking through, you know, cutting down trees. But like, despite those individual examples of farmland going away or farmland getting bought up by uber, uber wealthy people like Bill Gates, there's still a lot of land out there.
Yeah. America is mostly farmland.
Yeah.
And it really always has been, which is fun to think about. But yeah, I think the idea of, you know, just being in my life, talking to people, especially, I believe it or not, know a lot of people who don't know anything about agriculture, because I think a lot of people in the world don't.
Yeah.
I think the idea of like, oh no, we're running out of farmland, especially when we think about climate change, when we think about kind of the headlines people have seen, farmland is something we worry about, especially because of the, like, kind of what you just talked about, like the anecdotal, everyone knows of some like field in town or drive that they've done a million times that used to be empty and now it's full of shopping malls and like the 7 millionth bank branch and whatever, all of these things that seem kind of superfluous when we think about like, do we need 800,000 branches of this bank or do we need food to eat?
Yeah.
I think that anecdotal experience is very kind of prescient, but the reality is like, we have so much farmland, we use most of it not for food.
Right.
We use the vast majority of it actually for making, for growing corn and soybeans that are used for animal feed and biofuels, for better or worse. And yeah, we actually need like a very tiny amount of land to make all the food that we eat. So yeah, I don't know. I guess like the easy answer of like, are we running out of farmland? No, not really.
Yeah. Well, and but that's interesting too, just that so much of our agricultural land is corn and soy. And like when you drive cross country or, you know, drive through the Midwest or anything and you see those endless fields of corn, like I think for a lot of people, they think about, oh, it's summertime and I'm having a picnic and, you know, eating an ear of corn on the cob. But that most of that corn is not directly edible. People aren't going and picking an ear off, and, you know, stripping it down. Like it's getting turned into, as you said, fuels or food additives or livestock. Like, yeah, what is happening, I guess, to those fields of corn as people are driving around?
Yeah. So sweet corn is, yeah, you said it pretty well, is like it's vanishingly small in the like the total number of amount of corn that's grown in America. It is significantly less than 1% is sweet corn.
Yeah.
A rounding error, essentially 0% of it is sweet corn, which is fun to think about. Yeah. But yeah, so the vast majority of it, about a third, goes to biofuels, making corn ethanol. Happy to talk more about that. But yeah, ethanol is an interesting choice. It is a valuable fuel additive environmentally, actually, maybe surprisingly.
Hmm.
I think E85 is something we could debate about, but E10 is actually makes more sense than what we had before, which was a much more highly pollutive, no-knock fuel additive. So that's about a third of it. About a third goes to feed livestock. We feed cattle, pigs, poultry, corn often, because of the way we grow them, right? Confined animal feeding operations. They don't have access to other kinds of food. They can't graze, so they have to eat corn. Even though cattle in particular don't want to eat corn, they can't really digest it. It's pretty bad for them. And then about a third goes to other uses. We export a bunch of it to other countries. We use a little bit for kind of industrial uses. The fun thing about corn is we've been overproducing it for so long that we've found really ingenious ways to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And done lots of industrial applications. There's some great articles out there that talk about all of the different things that corn gets put into. Kind of materials used in making disposable diapers is a corn pulp product.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, corn is everywhere. It's wild. And then, yeah, some tiny, tiny amount of that, of the number two dent corn or the kind of more industrial dry corn product, goes into making like tortilla chips. But again, it's a vanishingly small amount. Oh, and then there's also popcorn, of course. But yeah, popcorn, sweet corn, and corn to make cornmeal that's edible is like a tiny, tiny amount.
It's so wild because, yeah, that is all you see. I mean, in every part, even here in Massachusetts, there are like, you know, any little corner of where someone can get 4 or 5 acres, they've planted corn there. It's wild.
Yeah.
I want to take the kind of content hat off for a second and go to kind of the producer hat, I guess, and talk about kind of the making of the new podcast as well. Like, I've been doing this podcast for 4 years now almost, and it's interview based. So I just, you know, I do this, I edit it a little bit and it goes up. Doing a narrative style podcast feels like a lot of work just in terms of doing the interviews and then figuring out how all the little sound bites fit together. I'm just curious to hear sort of about your process of actually making a podcast like that.
Totally. Well, I am probably going to, actual real podcast people that are listening to this are going to probably be appalled by my.
There's so many podcast people though. Like, it doesn't matter what's real anymore, right? There's like 20 million podcasts or whatever. So
it's so true, though, down like 80% from like 5 months ago. So yeah. I think, so I learned how to make podcasts from essentially a combination of, I used to be in news. So I learned how to kind of put a news package together. I did, for 550 or so straight days, I filed a 2 minute to 2 minute and 30 second news clip every day.
Yep.
So that was my trial by fire of learning how to edit, how to put sound clips together, how to hear good quotes, and then kind of link them succinctly and write to speak, which is very different than writing, to have it be read.
Sure.
So a combination of that and then also just listening to podcasts I love and then trying to imitate them.
Yeah.
Obviously, a big early fan of Serial. I've listened to Serial way too many times, but also like Radiolab, the NPR podcasts are just like exceptionally well done. And I love the use of music and in combination with words and the way that things are put together. So a lot of just like, I don't know, like what would a painter do? Like paint Van Gogh's paintings over and over again until they look kind of like Van Gogh's paintings. A lot of that. And then, a lot of just like, I am so nerdy and interested in this agricultural stuff that I have, you know, I have like 6 books sitting on my desk right now for the episode that I'm working on right now. A lot of just like write a 50-page script and then cut it down to 22 pages and, you know, do the interviews and hear, want to use like a full hour of what people say and then have to be like, I can use 8 minutes at most.
Yeah.
So let's find the best 8 minutes. So yeah, that is, in general, the process is just like, it's kind of a brute force. It does take a lot of time and a lot of editing, but it's really fun. And I love listening to like highly produced podcasts and listening to them as essays. And the interesting thing, having had the background in books, is that, you know, I think people look at kind of narrative podcasts and think like, oh my God, that's so much work. But compared to a book, it's actually not very much work.
Yeah.
And it's like the fact that I can like have an idea, sit down, like do the interviews and publish a podcast in like 6 weeks versus that same timeline for a book is like 2 years.
Sure.
Which in this historical moment where things move so fast, like I wrote my book and I loved it and it was so fun and interesting. And then by the time it came out, I was like, I don't even remember working on this kind of.
Right.
It was so long ago.
It becomes
that
a blur.
I love.
Totally.
Yeah, totally. So podcasts are a very fun, even the relatively higher production podcasts, like they're still so quick relative to other kind of forms of media. So. Worth it to me.
Totally. When you're conceiving of an episode, like how much are you sort of trying to find bites to fit within a script or an idea? And how much, like, is there kind of a phase like there would be when you're writing a book or reporting on a story where you're just kind of recording a bunch of interviews and seeing what sticks or seeing where the narrative threads are? Or are you kind of going in saying, okay, I know this is roughly the arc I want to take. Who are the guests that can kind of get me there? What's the sound that can get me there?
I would say maybe it's a little bit of both. I usually start with an outline, plug my guests in where I think they will go, but my level of detail is pretty low because I don't know what guests are going to say. And one of the things that I always say at the beginning of a podcast interview is like, listen, I've maybe shared an outline with you. I have questions that I've prepared, but like, you know this topic and I don't. So I'm going to follow you where you want to go. And if I'm not asking interesting questions, like just ignore them and you say the things that are most interesting to you.
Yeah,
that's always been super successful for me. I've definitely gone into interviews, you know, having done the background and thinking I have an idea of what's going to happen. And then they have, you know, one line in one answer. I was just like, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Let's abandon everything else I had planned and only talk about that for the next 30 minutes. And then I would say after the interviews are done, the outline often looks completely different.
Yeah.
And right. then I usually go from there.
Yeah. And then you're scripting kind of your voiceover and narration around once you have yes. sort of all those pieces. Yeah. Interesting. You also edit the podcast, right? And do like the technical
piece. I do,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
What part, I get, it's all so many different parts of your brain that you're engaging in all these things. Like, talk to me, I guess, about just the process of sort of taking off then that reporter or, you know, writer hat and then having to really dive into, you know, making it sound good, making it compelling, holding people's interest.
The sound mixing might actually be the part I like the most, which is bizarre to say as a writer, yeah. but I have always craved being like having some kind of like visual physical art. Like, I love painting. I'm terrible at it. I think pottery is yeah. fun. Terrible at it.
Yeah.
And sound editing like feels like that. It's a lot of like, there's like touch involved in like moving around the keyboard and kind of yeah. snipping things and smoothing things and making the sound sound just right. And that, yeah, it is a very different hat than the writing. It's a lot more intuitive. And I really enjoy that. It is like, my process is just like, I don't have like a strategy. I don't have rules. I'm just like given that this is what they've just said, like, how long do I think this pause needs to be? Like, let's just yeah. like feel it. You know, right. music choices, music cutting feels very similar, like where breaks are. It's hard to describe a process because it feels very intuitive, but I don't know. I really love it. It's a part that I think is compelling on the maybe business end of making podcasts. It's, I think, the average like person who would buy a podcast loves that they don't have to hire another person to right. do the technical part.
Yeah.
It's also just like, it's nice to have like just that little extra level of creative control and be able to, yeah. you know, at any moment, especially like day before this is about to launch and I'm like doing the last kind of cleanup and I can be like, you know what? I don't actually like that. The back half of that sentence, I'm going to take it out right now. Versus if yeah. when you're just doing kind of the narration and the writing, your part ends pretty early and then you have to hand it off to someone else and trust that they're going to kind of accomplish your vision, which I don't know. I don't have to do that. I get to do it the whole time.
Totally. It is interesting kind of that correlation between like visual arts, because I edit this podcast kind of surprisingly fairly heavily, actually. And there's something really fun for me in like when somebody's making a point, oftentimes people will stutter or they'll have an or, you know, things like that. And I take a lot of that stuff out. But there are times where I feel like it's important to leave it. And I find myself thinking about that more lately of kind of, you know, they'll say, well, the thing is, and I'll take that out, but then they'll say, the thing you got to understand. And you're like, ooh, that kind of word, that's, you know, there's poetry in that. It's just, I would never have thought condensing an interview, which is essentially all I'm doing, could be creative or artistic. And it so is. And there's something visual about the waveforms and seeing them move around that like, yeah, you realize just how visual it can be too. It's not just an oral exercise.
Yeah, that is like a part that is very hard to explain to people, especially if you haven't like seen what audio files look like. Because yeah, I mean, I make a couple of different podcasts and I am a producer and editor on some others. And so I've seen thousands and thousands of WAV files at this point. I know what like an looks like in a WAV file. Oh, totally. I can just like look yes. at it and see it.
Yep.
I don't need to hear the sound. I don't know. I love I'm in like an artsy headspace apparently. I love the idea that the difference between like a great painter and a master is usually, or a great painting and a masterpiece is one brushstroke.
Yeah.
And to me, like that kind of like translation to podcast is like, yeah, things like leaving in like the right breath.
Yes.
Because like people breathe.
Yes.
And like it makes people sound more human to like leave the right amount of like breathing and kind of like room to think, room for you to think and room for like the guests to think.
Yeah.
And yeah, that, I don't know. I am fascinated by and love that stuff. And I spend so much time thinking about it. It's probably embarrassing.
No, but it's like, and it becomes this second nature thing that like any art, I guess, when you have to stop and analyze it and be like, oh, wait, why am I making these? Here's what I'm thinking about. This has been a wild conversation. Just we've gone from ag issues to podcasting technique. But to kind of wrap it all up, I'm curious, you know, I've only had a chance to hear the first episode of the new podcast and talking about running out of farmland. I think it's an 8-part series, right? Like what can you tease sort of what's in store for people? And I think by the time this interview is released, there will be some more out in the marketplace as well. But, you know, for people that want to hear more episodes, what else is coming?
Totally. So yeah, we are in the process of kind of putting final touches on episode 2, which is about farmland and property and how kind of farmland in America's past really cemented the specific and very uniquely American ideas of how property, private property works, which is a bit of a pet passion of mine. But also like what you were talking about at the beginning with, you know, how land, the land and labor trade-off in early America, kind of part of our original sin there. We'll have lots of talk about that. So if you're interested, our episode after that is going to be about homesteading and how kind of the homestead movement, giving away free land, how that worked, how that, you know, affects intergenerational wealth, how it affects things like public schools, which I teased a little bit here on that as well. After that, we're going to have some episodes on dispossession, especially how Black landowners have been kind of systematically dispossessed, but also many other groups in America have been systematically denied access to farmland and what that means for things like modern housing and the modern housing crisis. And then in the back half of the run, we're going to focus maybe a little bit less historically and look at things like the financialization of farmland, how people have turned it into like an investment asset, how your 401k or your insurance policy is directly related to farmland. How things like the quality of your local beaches is related to farmland.
Interesting.
And then I think we're going to have some final episodes that explore some kind of environmental themes and then kind of the mythology, which is maybe the one I am most excited about. You know, you touched on the quote you read from the book kind of alluded to my, again, kind of personal obsession with just how much agricultural mythology there is all around us. Like Old MacDonald, you know, is it maybe the first nursery rhyme most people learn? And, you know, I don't think we ever think about what that means and how it kind of influences the way that we think about farming and agriculture and food in our society. But the mythology is all around us. And even people who would say, you know, I don't really know that much about agriculture, you know more than you think.
Yeah.
And what you do know is creating a bias, essentially, is it one way or another. And I think farmland is such an interesting lens to look at these different kind of impacts because it is such a, I don't know, I think land in general is kind of like an afterthought in America, which is bizarre because most wealth in America is like land-based. You know, it's farmers love to say, you know, buy dirt because God isn't making any more of it. That's not really true of anything else. Like every other thing you can buy is like essentially maybe infinite.
Yeah.
But not land. So I don't know. Land is a very unique thing.
And that wealth piece is, that's farmers, but that's also if you have a, you know, a small house in Levittown with a tiny yard, like that's everybody's biggest source of wealth. If you're a homeowner or a landowner, like
100%.
And it touches every part of America. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole American dream, the idea of the American dream, the like essential oldest version of it is just property ownership.
Yeah.
So like, what does that mean about, well, and something I've been thinking about a lot recently, one of the ideas that the founders had about why property ownership was so important is because it's like military implications, because like no one defends land quite the way they defend land they own. And so like basically like you'd never, literally verbatim words that Thomas Jefferson wrote, is like, we'll never have to worry about raising an army if everyone owns their land, because who wouldn't rise to protect what's theirs? And there was never a, there, like Europeans were not aware of another nation on earth that was populated by individual landowners. That was like beyond the scope of what was like what they could conceive. And the idea of a nation built on property ownership was like so revolutionary. It's so, we have normalized it in such an interesting way in this country, but it was so unique. And we're kind of undoing it right now. Right? Like people can't really afford to buy property. Certainly middle class people can't.
Sure.
But yeah, it's, I don't know. There is something fundamentally American. I talk a little bit in this coming episode about the Thomas Jefferson's idea of life, liberty, and property. And he replaced the word property with the pursuit of happiness. But like really, he meant property. Like property was happiness to them. It was something they could have never imagined having. I mean, not Thomas Jefferson himself. He was obviously the heir of two plantations and owned 5,000 acres when he died. But other people never dreamt of owning property. And so the idea of a nation founded on property ownership was wild. And we have had a wild country for like 300-400 years. And what are we going to do if we stop being a nation of property ownership? Then who will we be?
There's a teaser. You got to tune in now and listen to the last episode of the show to find out. All right, Sarah Mock there. What an amazing conversation. I mean, as I was saying at the end, we hit on everything from, you know, the history of farms to racial and social justice issues to podcasting and what it takes to edit a good show. So I am just so thankful for Sarah's time. I'm thankful for her voice in this space. And I am thankful for all the work that she is doing talking about these ag issues and telling these stories in ways that they might not otherwise have been told. I really appreciate that. Check out The Only Thing That Lasts, Sarah's new podcast for Amberg Research. It is streaming now on all your favorite podcast players. Read Sarah's books, Farm and Other F-Words, Big Team Farms, lots of great stuff in there. And hey, while I'm plugging stuff, make sure you're subscribed to the newsletter. Get on that list now, heathrasella.com/newsletter. You'll get the newsletter delivered to your inbox, and you'll also get podcast alerts for every new episode. I'm at Heath Rasella on social media. Give me a follow over there. Leave some reviews in your favorite podcast player, 5 stars. And thank you for listening. I will talk to you in 2 weeks. Until then, stay safe.